Iran's president says the presence of foreigners in West Asia increases in security, stressing regional cooperation will lead to peace and security. U.S. warns that citizens to avoid traveling to the UAE following recent drone and missile attacks by the Yemeni army against Abu Dhabi. And the Venezuelan opposition fails to collect the minimum number of signatures required for a recall referendum against President Nicolas Maduro. Hello everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. In our top story, the Iranian president has expressed concern over the presence of foreigners in West Asia, warning such presence only increases insecurity in the region. Ebrahim Raisi stressed the importance of cooperation among regional countries for the insurance of security and peace. He noted that such cooperation is also beneficial for the progress of regional nations. Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with the Qatari foreign minister in Tehran. Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al-Thani also echoed the Iranian president's stance on regional cooperation, noting the presence of foreign forces will have adverse consequences for the region. The Qatari official is on an official visit to Iran for a series of high-level meetings on regional issues. He met with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, earlier on Thursday. Political commentator Sarah Flounder says U.S. has a policy of dividing and impoverishing the West Asia region, which is part of its colonial mentality.
This is a colonial mentality, and certainly the United States knows that every country in the region wants them out, and Iran has every right to open up bilateral relations with each country. And many countries literally need it for survival, because one by one, U.S. policy is to divide them, to sanction them, to separate them from each other, to try to impoverish the entire region, to make each country dependent on U.S. imperialism and its allies. And when you consider U.S. sanctions on Iran, but also on Iraq, on Syria, on Lebanon, Yemen, into the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, South Sudan. Regionally, this is the big problem, that every country is under attack, is under sanctions, is under U.S. bases, naval bases, military bases in the region. So that resistance is growing, and Iran is a force for stability in the region.
Iran's deputy UN envoy once again calls for the removal of inhumane sanctions on Syria, saying the unlawful measures prolong the suffering of the Syrian people. In an address to the UN Security Council, Zahra Ershadi says unilateral sanctions against Syria have adversely affected the work of international and national humanitarian agencies in the country. She says the key to alleviate the suffering is to maintain country sovereignty and territorial integrity. To that end, the Iranian envoy has called on countries that are illegally present in Syria to end their occupation. She also called for an end to aggression of Israeli regime against the Arab country. The Syrian military prosecution says it's obtained and documented evidence of numerous U.S. violations in Syria during the years-long war. It's also vowed to judicially pursue all Americans who committed crimes or undermined the state's sovereignty. Muhammad Ali reports from Damascus.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or U.N. mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S.-Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Iran has called on the UN to take immediate measures to halt the killing of defenseless Yemenis by the Saudi-led coalition. In a letter to the UN representative for Yemen, a senior advisor to Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran condemns the bombings of cities, civilian buildings, and infrastructure in Yemen. Ali Asghar Khaji said Saudi-led coalition's atrocities run counter to international laws. He says that Yemen's crisis has no military solution. The Iranian diplomat also has called for the lifting of a Saudi-imposed blockade on the country that's exacerbated Yemen's humanitarian crisis. The Saudi-led coalition has carried out dozens of deadly airstrikes on Yemen this week. In one such attack, more than 90 people were killed when coalition warplanes bombed a prison in Yemen. Meanwhile, a group of protesters have gathered outside the UN office in Tehran, condemning recent Saudi airstrikes in Yemen, which killed dozens of civilians. Protesters are demanding the UN take action to end the ongoing Saudi war on its southern neighbor. Yusuf Jalali has your story.
Stop the Saudi war on Yemen. This is what these protesters demand as they gathered outside the United Nations office in Tehran. The rally came in reaction to last week's deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition that targeted a detention facility in Yemen. The United Nations did express its concern for the escalation of the conflict, but protesters here say it's not enough.
We gathered in front of the UN office to say that all of the crimes that are being committed against civilians are happening because the United Nations has given the Saudi criminals a green light by staying silent and watching.
For 7 years, the Yemeni nation has been facing the cruelest blockade and deadliest airstrikes, but no one is doing anything to help the Yemenis.
This time, besides targeting innocent people, Saudi Arabia also targeted the internet infrastructure to prevent your crimes from being reflected to the world. So we are the voices of our Yemeni brothers and sisters, and we are here to tell the world about the Saudi crimes.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015, with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, along with the army, leads the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. These people say, despite Riyadh's strong logistic support from the US and UK, Yemen has made headways against the Saudi invaders and left the kingdom and its allies bogged down in the country.
The enemy is facing a hard time. Saudi Arabia tried its best and plundered its money on American and British weapons to bring our nation to its knees. But our resistance has burst their bubble. And as you see, they are resorting to barbaric ways to achieve their evil goals. But we keep resisting until our land is free.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen, which blocks the entry of humanitarian and medical supplies into the war-torn country.
The Saudi war on Yemen is slammed here as a crime against humanity, a crime that these people say continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Protesters here say it's time for the UN to do more than condemning the crimes committed by Riyadh and take action to bring the Yemeni suffering to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
U.S. has warned its citizens against traveling to the United Arab Emirates, citing the threat of missile or drone attacks. This is the highest level of travel advisory issued by the State Department. It says the possibility of attacks affecting U.S. citizens and interests remains an ongoing and serious concern. Washington had already urged Americans against traveling to the UAE because of COVID. Latest warning follows recent retaliatory drone and missile attacks by the Yemeni army against major Emirati cities. Attacks were in response to relentless bombings of Yemen by a Saudi-led coalition in which the UAE is an active partner. The Yemeni army has warned it will further strike if the UAE does not stop its war campaign against Yemen. Venezuela's National Electoral Commission has rejected a request for a referendum on President Nicolas Maduro, citing lack of signatures for a recall vote. Now, the commission gave Maduro's opponents 12 hours on Wednesday to collect a minimum of 4.2 million signatures from the country's eligible voters, but efforts could receive only 1% of the country's 21 million-strong voter registry. On Thursday, the council announced that Maduro's opponents failed to collect enough signatures to proceed with a referendum on his presidency. Venezuela's constitution allows officials who have completed at least half of their term to be removed from office by a vote. The U.S. Drinking water supplies are absolutely vulnerable to large-scale disruption by hackers. That's according to a senior American official. Official warned cyber defenses for the country's water supplies are absolutely inadequate to deal with hackers. He added, threshold of resilience is not what it needs to be. The official expressed concern that a cyber attack could disable or manipulate water treatment processes and could even stop the flow of water supplies. Some officials enrolled a plan to get water companies to work with the government to shore up security gaps. There are an estimated 150,000 water systems serving 300 million Americans. Thousands of French workers have gone on strike demanding a salary rise amid a hike in the cost of living. Workers from heavy industry, transport, farming, and public services, as well as teachers, are taking part in the strikes. France's major labor union, the CGT, says over 170 demonstrations and marches have been held across the country. Industrial action has also disrupted regional train services in the capital, Paris. France experienced an inflation rate of 2.8% over the course of 2021. The country's workers' unions have criticized the government for failing to introduce a boost to the minimum wage over the past year. The controversial Nationality and Borders Bill is still causing a stir in Britain as the government seeks to grant itself more powers to revoke citizenship without having to inform the person in advance. Critics fear that the bill empowers racism and makes minorities vulnerable to state persecution and authoritarianism. Robert Carter explains.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust Number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonized by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those. I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
North Korea has confirmed its latest missile launches amid growing tensions with the United States over the country's nuclear weapons program. State media KCNA said one of the tests was an upgraded long-range cruise missile and the other a warhead of tactical guided missile. On Wednesday, the South Korean military said it detected the launch of two short-range ballistic missiles. Launches drew condemnation from the U.S. North Korea has recently said it will bolster its defenses against the U.S. and consider resuming all temporarily suspended activities. Iran has won the ticket for the 2022 Qatar World Cup after winning over the Iraqi team at Azadi Stadium in Tehran. Salman Kujuri reports.
Iran has become the first Asian team to qualify for this year's World Cup in Qatar with a 1-0 win over Iraq in Tehran. Mehdi Taremi scored the only goal of the match to send Iran through to the World Cup finals for the sixth time. Team Melli consolidated their position on top of the Group A table with 19 points, 2 points ahead of South Korea. They extended their impressive unbeaten run since Croatian head coach Dragan Skocic took over in February 2020 with 11 wins and 1 draw. Iran has played in the World Cup 5 times in the past, in 1978, 1999, 2006, 2014 and 2018, while Iraq's last and only participation was in Mexico, back in 1986.
Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you, early in the morning. With you, at midday. With you, till the night's end. Radio.
In the limelight. Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick announced on Tuesday, 25th of January, that her officers are investigating charges of law-breaking at the heart of the British government, on the basis of evidence unearthed during an inquiry by the senior civil servant Sue Gray. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Vikram Dodd and Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled Boris Johnson Braced for Perilous 48 Hours with Release of Sue Gray's Report. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is braced for the most perilous days of his premiership, with exasperated Conservative MPs due to see an official report into Downing Street parties that has now triggered a criminal inquiry. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick announced on Tuesday, 25th of January, that her officers are investigating charges of law-breaking at the heart of government on the basis of evidence unearthed during an inquiry by senior civil servant Sue Gray. In what appeared to be a hint about what Sue Gray has discovered, Cressida Dick said, "I don't anticipate any difficulty in obtaining the evidence, that it is necessary, proportionate and appropriate for us to obtain in order to get to the right conclusions. Those found to have breached regulations could be fined." Former No. 10 Downing Street staffers told The Guardian that the police inquiry will uncover evidence which has not yet been submitted to Sue Gray. One senior Conservative said the Scotland Yard inquiry was a different ballgame, adding, "Officials who don't tell Sue Gray the whole truth will not hold back from the police." Downing Street sources refused to be drawn on whether the Prime Minister could give the green light for the report to be released as soon as Wednesday, 26th of January, but it is certainly expected within days. A senior government source cautioned it was unlikely to be published in full, saying, "You don't need to be a lawyer to realise that if there's an ongoing police investigation, there are constraints on what you can publish." Sue Gray has interviewed witnesses and examined key evidence, including security logs showing who was in Downing Street and when. She is also thought to have been shown photographs of parties through Cabinet Office sources, stressed these were unlikely to be included in the report. It is understood that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner's decision to investigate a number of parties in Downing Street and Whitehall was made on Sunday, 23rd of January. Boris Johnson had been informed in advance but opted not to tell his cabinet at their weekly meeting, leaving them to find out as they emerged and triggering consternation. Asked why cabinet ministers were not told, the Prime Minister's spokesperson said, "From what I understand, it's important not to preempt a police statement on this sort of issue at any point." Many Conservative MPs are awaiting Sue Gray's findings before deciding whether to add their names to those calling on the 1922 committee chair, Graham Brady, to trigger a vote of no confidence. One senior MP suggested Tory backbenchers would be likely to come to a collective decision when they see how Boris Johnson responds. They said, "Those colleagues that still have a foot in the real world will recognise that there is no world in which a police investigation is anything but very bad," adding that in any normal workplace, those under investigation would be suspended rather than coming to work as normal. A former cabinet minister suggested Graham Brady may already have received 40 letters. The threshold for triggering a confidence vote is 54 letters. If it is reached, a vote will be held within days, and if Boris Johnson lost it, his premiership would effectively be over. Boris Johnson's press secretary insisted recently that Johnson would be determined to fight any vote of no confidence rather than resign. The Prime Minister continued to adopt a defiant stance on Tuesday, 25th of January. Briefing MPs on the crisis in Ukraine and entertaining wavering colleagues at number 10. He told the House of Commons, "I welcome the Metropolitan Police Commissioner's decision to conduct its own investigation because I believe this will help to give the public the clarity it needs and help to draw a line under matters." Asked whether Johnson believed he had broken the law, his spokesman said, "It's fair to say he does not." At Cabinet, Boris Johnson hailed the benefits of Brexit and urged his colleagues to be bold and go further and faster in driving forward the government's reform agenda. One backbencher said Boris Johnson's team had been working hard in winning over MPs tempted to call for his removal, saying they had been trying to charm backbenchers. However, another pointed to an atmosphere of intimidation after a series of reports in recent days about the heavy-handed tactics of Boris Johnson's whips and other close allies. On a day of twists and turns at Westminster, it initially appeared that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner's inquiry would delay publication of Sue Gray's report. Johnson's spokesman subsequently suggested that just those aspects of the report unrelated to the parties being investigated by the police could be released. He said, "My understanding is that she can publish those elements that are not subject to further work." But it later emerged that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner had no objections to the report's publication. Conservative MPs lined up to defend the Prime Minister during an urgent question on the investigation by Labour's Deputy Leader Angela Rayner. The Conservative MP Giles Watling described the urgent question as a vexatious waste of everybody's time, but was forced to withdraw his claims by the Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, who decides urgent questions. Sir Edward Lee said, "When Europe stands on the brink of war and there is cost of living crisis, can we please have a sense of proportion over the Prime Minister being given a piece of cake in his own office by his own staff?" The Liberal Democrat leader Ed Davies said later, "A sitting Prime Minister is under police investigation. If he had a scrap of shame, he'd resign. He thinks he's above the law, but he's not, and it's time for him to go." On Monday, ITV News reported that up to 30 staff gathered in the Downing Street Cabinet Room in June of 2020 with a cake and picnic food from Marks & Spencer to sing happy birthday to the Prime Minister and give him a birthday cake. The event, which Number 10 has denied was a party, was said to have been organised by his wife, Carrie, and briefly attended by the interior designer, Lulu Little. Seeking to defend Boris Johnson against the allegation on Tuesday evening, one of his close confidants, Northern Ireland Minister Conor Burns, claimed the Prime Minister had been, in a sense, ambushed with a cake.
Thought.
Hello everyone, and let us reflect on a statement by Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, regarding his immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. "Surely my daughter Fatima is the leader of all women from the beginning to the end. She is part of me and the light of my eyes. She is the flower of my heart and is my soul. She is a human Huri, who whenever she stands in prayers in the presence of her Lord, exalted is his name, her light illuminates the skies for the angels, like stars shine to people on earth."
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Servant Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Ba'd al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة الإمام موسى بن جعفر الكاظم عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so, the blood of Imam Musa al-Kadhim was the blood of the Holy Prophet. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed imam in the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. It is very well known, and it has been unanimously agreed upon by the different biographers and historians, that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam bestowed greatly upon the poor. He was very generous, and he would bestow upon the deprived ones, the downtrodden, the oppressed, and the weak in the dark of night, lest someone should recognize him. It is interesting, but this manner, this sunnah of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam can be traced from his fathers to his forefathers all the way to his ancestor, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. It is interesting, but we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam generously spent what he had on the weak and the afflicted. He showered the weak and the afflicted and the poor and the deprived and the downtrodden with as much as he could give. And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam tried as hard as he could to save as many of them as he could from the bitterness of poverty and deprivation. These, my friends, are the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: لا يخلد الله في النار إلا أهل الكفر والجحود وأهل الضلال والشرك، ومن اجتنب الكبائر من المؤمنين لم يسأل عن الصغائر.
إمام الكاظم عليه السلام stated: Allah will not retain anybody in the fire permanently except the people of disbelief, denial, error, and polytheism, and whoever shuns the grave sins from among the believers will not be asked about the minor ones.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that he talked about wealth, and he talked about the distribution of wealth, and he talked about how we should help, protect, strengthen, and uplift the poor and the downtrodden. And so we find in one of these very beautiful conversations, now as a tangent, it is unfortunate that we don't have more conversations from this truly beautiful, divinely appointed Imam, but this is again because he was under such severe oppression and torture and tyranny that a lot of these things have not been relayed to us through history. But by the grace and the blessings of Allah, that which has been given to us and has been relayed are truly things that are beautiful, profound, and can change our lives really for the better and for forever. So this one time, a poor man visited Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam and begged him, you know, for money or something. And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he intended to test this poor man in order to give him some money. And the money that he wanted to give to the poor man would be as equal to the knowledge of this poor man. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam asked the poor guy, the poor individual, if you were given to wish something in this world, what would you wish for? The poor man, he said, I would wish that I would be provided with piety, taqwa, God consciousness, God awareness in my religion, in my deen, and that I would fulfill the rights of my brothers against me. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam approved of this poor man's answer and ordered that the poor man be given 1,000 dinars. Now at that time, I don't know if you know or you don't, but 1,000 dinars was a lot of money. In response to what? In response to the fact that the answer that this poor man gave to this question of what would you wish for if you were to be given anything in this world, the man said two things. One is to have taqwa, God consciousness, piety, fear of Allah, cautiousness of Allah, wary of Allah in his religion, in his deen. And the second thing was to fulfill the rights of one's brother. Now this isn't just one's blood brother, this is one's brother in faith, one's brother in deen. And Islam being an all-inclusive, comprehensive, all-encompassing religion, this even goes to the rights that an individual has with their brother who is a human being. For we are the brothers and sisters of all human beings, and we have rights that should be fulfilled as regards to them. And of course, we are the brothers and sisters of the Muslims, and those are rights that we must fulfill. So the value of these two things shown to us in this beautiful conversation, this is Dialogue Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Salamullahi Alayhi told his companions that I have called him Musa because he resembles the Prophet of Allah in his appearance. And Imam Alayhi Salam was the only Imam of the Ahlul Bayt to be called after a Prophet other than his great grandfather Rasulullah Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. The Imam alayhi salam thereafter was trained in the household of nobility, purity, chastity, righteousness. The Imam's qualities and exceptional characteristics emerged from a young age. The narrations tell us that once Abu Hanifa al-Nu'man came to see Imam al-Sadiq in Medina. Imam al-Sadiq was busy. Abu Hanifa stands outside. He looks at the young man who's standing outside the house of Imam al-Sadiq. He says to him, "O young man, do you have a place whereby an individual wants to relieve themselves would go to?" This young man would reply back by saying, "Indeed, go to a place where no one can see you. Go to where no plants are being grown. Go to somewhere where you are not directing yourself towards the Qibla, then you can relieve yourself." Abu Hanifa was very much inspired by this answer. He looked at this man and said, "Who are you?" This young individual said, "I am Musa, the son of Ja'far, ابن محمد الصادق سلام الله عليه.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately 1 million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. Now, with the Chinese New Year approaching, a Vietnamese artist is honoring the zodiac sign of 2022 by making different objects that look like tigers.
I often introduce collections for the zodiac animal of the next year. It's going to be the year of the tiger soon. There are 2022 carvings in this collection, which align with the number of this year. Also, I am very fond of tigers as an animal, as they are so powerful, yet so majestic.
Tam Pat has his workshop in a village on the outskirts of the capital, Hanoi. The 39-year-old artist makes tigers using wood from jackfruit trees, which Vietnamese often use to make spiritual items. He applies crushed eggshells and seashells to give shape to the tiger's stripes. The artist is also carving some tigers purely out of laterite, the mineral still used in some villages to build homes. It takes Tam Pat about 2 weeks to come up with a tiger-looking object. This year, he is trying to make his creations in a way that can be used in everyday life. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. Tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain momentum, some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with a novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zara is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
The plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is. But I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zora says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zora had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zora says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be?
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
In the world of art, a Japanese artist named Sachi is creating incredibly realistic felted wool portraits of cats. Sachi calls her artworks Wakuneko, which directly translates to frame cat. Her work is highly popular and she has more than 600,000 followers on different social media platforms. Each portrait takes a whopping 1 month to complete. The crafting process starts with Sachi looking at dozens of photos of the cat she wants to replicate. Then she prepares the required materials before preparing the foundation and mounts the felt onto it. The most difficult part of the job is making the subject's eyes. According to Sachi, it is also the most special stage.
I think that the moment when the cat's spirit enters into the artwork can be presented through the eyes. In that sense, I have been very particular about how to make the eyes.
Sachi's portraits have inspired people around the world to adopt homeless cats. Now she hopes to hold an exhibition showing various cats, including ones with physical handicaps, in order to inspire more adoptions of shelter cats.
Disability is not an obstacle to success. A group of Japanese with disabilities has proved it as they create incredible handicraft and make a living this way. A shop called Amayaka offers the items made by these disabled individuals. Located in a Tokyo neighborhood, it showcases products ranging from scarves and bags to glassware and colorful carts. Mayaka and all other workshops are part of a new movement aimed at promoting works of people with impairment. In just one of the workshops cooperating with Mayaka, about 20 disabled people are working over there. However, organizers of the movement say these people are still invisible in the society and are not paid fairly for their works despite being experienced in craftsmanship.
Some workers here have a career of more than 30 years. They have been weaving since their school days. They are so experienced that we should refer to them as artisans.
The organizers say they hope that their initiative will promote the works of the people with disabilities and help the society to start thinking about the way disabled workers are being treated. Turtles get a second chance to spread their fins after being found with bellies full of plastic. They were rescued and are now being released back to the sea in Argentina. Two green turtles and four loggerhead turtles were saved from fishing nets in Buenos Aires province. The group was taken to Grupo Marina Foundation, where they recuperated after purging 10 types of plastic from their bodies. Rehabilitation of the turtles lasted over a month and included blood tests and other procedures to make sure they were free of plastic. A biologist with a foundation says the danger of plastic is that it's silent and usually its dangers are so gradual that it goes unnoticed.
Many times the animal appears to be in perfect health. However, during the checkup and evaluation, we found a large amount of this material inside. So it is important to get rid of the plastic before the condition worsens and it ends up causing the deaths of the specimens.
The turtles had mistakenly eaten plastic, thinking it was food. Wind, waves, and sunshine break down discarded plastic into tiny pieces, which litter ocean waters. Much of this plastic waste can be found on beds of seaweed that turtles forage for food. This trash ends up fatally clogging their bellies, causing the decline in the population of this graceful reptile.
Thank you.
The Indian administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat, and a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir disallowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here, and every day I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mails, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
This is IOIB English Radio.
IOIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The showdown over voting rights in the US Senate may be over for now. But the issue still smouldering in a stretch of northeast Georgia countryside where local officials recently introduced a plan to close 7 polling sites and consolidate them into one. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Richard Fawcett and Michael Wines. The piece is titled, In a Georgia County, Deep Distrust Over a